Imagine that you're floating. All around you is darkness, and you're the coldest you've ever been. Behind you is the moon, faithfully following its orbit, and beyond that, the Earth, a speck of blue 1,000,000 miles away. You look out into space, able to detect light at a wavelength slightly greater than that of red on the visible spectrum, allowing you to gaze out into the void with less restrictions than your peers. As you stare patiently into the inky depths of the cosmos, a small bead of light, that of a distant star, appears in the distance, faint and weary from the distance it has traveled to meet you. And it's ancient, far older than anything you've ever encountered, nearly as old as time itself. Soon, the small bead of light is joined by tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of others that populate your field of vision, until what you see before you mirrors the tumultuous roar of television static, and you realize that the millions of pinpoints of light you see before you are not stars, but galaxies, many of which have been born, lived, and died before the light has even met your eyes. You know your mission well, setting to work on the seemingly endless process of documenting what you see before you, reporting back to Earth all that you, the James Webb Space Telescope, witness at the birthplace of the universe. I'm Nate Ray, and this is the Rocket Launch Pod.
OTC is go.
Pegasus is go.
PTC is go.
HAPS is go.
Houston flight is go.
Launch director, NTD, our launch team is ready to proceed at this time.
Ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
This is Houston, say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us with the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them.
Lift off. Americans return to space as Discovery clears the tower.
It's gone, the shuttle. And that those aboard it could not have and did not survive.
Booster ignition and liftoff of Endeavour, completing Kibo and fulfilling Japan's hope for an out-of-this-world space laboratory.
Ignition, liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon, go NASA, go SpaceX, Godspeed, bottom dog!
So I am an astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and my research area is on distant galaxies. So I'm interested in how galaxies grow and change over time and how galaxies form their stars and black holes.
That's Amber Strawn. She's the deputy project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope.
Part of my functional work at NASA is on the James Webb Space Telescope science team. And so Webb is being built right now to be the scientific successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's been in work for over 2 decades now. It's the largest, most complex, and I believe will be the most awesome space telescope that NASA has ever built.
Okay. So if you've seen any of the breathtaking pictures Hubble has sent back to Earth since its launch in 1990, the ones where every part of the image is occupied by a tiny pinpoint of light representing a distant galaxy, you might be asking, why do we need another telescope in space? What's wrong with the Hubble telescope? While Hubble's track record has been incredibly impressive, having made more than 1,000,000 observations of the universe over the last 30 years, the Webb telescope promises to take deep space observation to the next level.
The Webb telescope is really designed to answer some of the biggest questions in astronomy today that Hubble just can't quite get to. So Hubble has been incredible, and it has really just revolutionized our understanding of the universe in fundamental ways. But there's a lot of ways that we've sort of pushed Hubble to its limits. And so Webb is really designed to step in where Hubble leaves off and answer some of these big science questions. And because of that, it is quite different from Hubble in a few key ways. The first distinguishing factor about Webb is just its sheer size. So the Hubble Space Telescope is about the size of a school bus. And so it was designed to fit inside the shuttle, the space shuttle payload, to get into space. The Webb Telescope is several stories high, and it has a sun shield that's about the size of a tennis court. So it is huge. It is by far the biggest telescope that NASA has ever designed to send into space. And having a telescope this big really allows us to be able to advance in astronomy. So the size of a telescope's mirror in particular really sort of defines in a lot of ways the power of the telescope. And so the Webb Telescope mirror is about 6.5 times bigger than Hubble. And with that, it will allow it to just simply gather more light and will also allow it to see in finer detail. So that's what the size of a telescope's mirror does. So with the Webb Telescope's huge mirror, its advanced detectors, and the type of light it will see, the wavelength coverage, it'll basically make Webb about 100 times more powerful than Hubble, if you can believe that. So that's the first big difference, is just the size. The second big difference between Hubble and Webb is the type of light that Webb will see. So Hubble sees the universe primarily in optical, visible light, like your eyes see. The Webb Telescope will see the universe primarily in infrared light, or light that is a little bit more red than what your eyes can detect. Webb will have some capability in the visible range as well, but will mostly be focused on infrared. And that is completely driven by the science questions. So the biggest science questions we have in astronomy today will be answered by looking at the universe in infrared light. And so that's the second key difference, is the type of light that Webb will see. The third big difference between Hubble and Webb is really where the telescopes are in space. So the Hubble Space Telescope orbits the Earth about 350 miles up. It orbits the Earth once every 90 minutes. And because of that, of course, it was able to be serviced by astronauts. The Webb Telescope is going to be 1 million miles from Earth. That's about 4 times further away than the moon. And we're putting Webb out into deep space so that it can get very, very cold. So I mentioned that Webb will see the universe in infrared light. So you could sort of think about infrared light like heat radiation. And so because Webb will be looking for these faint infrared light signals, the telescope itself, the optics and the mirrors, have to be extremely cold, basically so the telescope doesn't see itself glowing. And so to get it that cold, we put it out into deep space. So that's the third big difference between Hubble and Webb, is where it's going to be in space.
Now, this is probably not the first time you've heard the name of the James Webb Space Telescope. And if you have heard of it before, there's a reason for that. Development on the telescope began in 1996, with a launch initially planned for 2007. In 2005, amid delays and cost overruns, the project underwent a major redesign. Construction of the telescope was completed in 2016, at which point it began an extensive testing phase. The telescope is now set to launch in November of this year. With the project in its 25th year, what's the reason for all the delays? Well, Strawn says it's because
Webb is the most ambitious and the most complex astronomical space observatory that NASA has ever built, or really that humanity has ever built. And so the fact that it is so big and it has to be cold makes it this difficult to build. And so, of course, the reasons for that, first of all, being so big, we don't have any rockets that are big enough to launch this telescope into space fully deployed. So the whole telescope has to be built so that it can be folded up and so that it can deploy and unfold once it's in space. So we have some incredible animations on our website. If you go to webb.nasa.gov, you can see some of these videos that show how this gigantic telescope will unfold in space. So the fact that it's so big makes it really difficult, cutting edge engineering for the first thing. And then the fact that it has to be so cold also makes it super difficult, because as you probably know, materials, just any kind of material, changes drastically when it gets very cold. So temperature differences, of course, cause these drastic changes in materials. And so obviously we have to build the telescope on Earth, but we have to build it to work in very, very cold of deep space. So the fact that this is the biggest and most ambitious telescope that NASA's ever built means that it has been very, very difficult. It's an enormous engineering challenge. And when you do something for the first time, you are always going to encounter challenges and difficulties. And we had to actually invent 10 new technologies just to get this telescope going. And so it's been incredibly difficult. And the fact is that we've had delays. You know, we've had several launch delays along the way because we've encountered problems that we didn't expect. And part of what makes this telescope so challenging is, of course, the fact that it's going to be so far away. We can't send astronauts to fix it. And so it has to be right. It has to be perfect when it launches into space. And so that means multiple rounds of testing here on the ground to make sure that it works like it's supposed to once it gets to space. And in the process of those tests, we have found problems. we found unexpected problems that we've had to fix. And then once you fix those problems, you have to retest to make sure that the fix worked. And so we've had several instances where that has caused us to have to stretch the schedule out. So it's absolutely a fact that when you do something incredibly difficult for the very first time, there are going to be immense challenges.
So, given the immense engineering challenges associated with creating a super powerful orbiting space observatory, what makes the Webb telescope worth the work and the wait?
The really exciting thing about a huge telescope like this is it can do so many different things. So, of course, NASA has smaller telescopes that are focused on doing one specific thing. A great example of that is the TESS telescope that is in space right now, and it's designed specifically to find exoplanets and to find a certain type of exoplanets near Earth. So many telescopes, smaller telescopes like that, are sort of designed to do one specific thing. The great thing about observatories like Webb is that it really can do a bunch of different types of astronomy. And it was specifically designed to answer a few key questions or sort of address a few key science themes. The first and one of the primary drivers of building the Webb telescope was to be able to find the very first galaxies that were born after the Big Bang. So the Hubble Space Telescope has allowed us to see galaxies from nearby galaxies all the way back to distant galaxies, but it has reached a limit. It's reached the edge of what it can see. And so with Webb, we're going to be able to push past that edge and hopefully see the very first galaxies that were born after the Big Bang.
Let's pause for a second here, because this is where the mission of the Webb Telescope can get pretty mind-bending. And that's because when you're dealing with observing objects in deep space, distance, specifically the distance light has traveled, becomes a measure of time. That's because light is the fastest moving thing in the universe. How fast? Well, light travels at a speed of 186,000 miles per second, which means that a light year, which is exactly what it sounds like, how far light can travel in a year, is 5.88 trillion miles. What does this have to do with time? Well, take for example a star that is one light year away from Earth. That means that from the moment light is emitted from the star, it takes 1 year for the light to reach Earth. So, when a telescope, like Hubble, takes a picture of that star, Hubble is really taking a picture of light that is a year old. So, Hubble is seeing that star as it appeared 1 year ago. In other words, Hubble wouldn't be able to see what the star looks like today until 1 year from now. What this all means is that the farther away the objects a telescope can see are, the further back in time the telescope is looking, because if that telescope is powerful enough to see a celestial body that's, say, 2.9 trillion miles away, that is, 50 light years, that means the telescope can look 50 years into the past. So, how far back in time is the Big Bang?
Over 13.5 billion years. This is a part of space that has never been observed before at all. And Webb should be able to see them for the very first time. So that's really exciting science, and that was one of the primary drivers of Webb. But as I said, when you build a telescope so big and so powerful, it'll be able to do a ton of other things as well. And so some of the other key science themes that Webb will address are, first of all, the evolution of galaxies over time. So because it will be able to see those first galaxies, of course, it will be able to see more nearby galaxies as well. And so we sort of put together this picture of how galaxies change over time by taking snapshots of galaxies at different points in the universe's history. And so by taking these snapshots, we can sort of put together the picture of how galaxies like our Milky Way grow over time. And then another big science theme that we hope to learn more about with Webb is how stars are born. And that sounds pretty fundamental, and that's because it is. Stars are the building blocks of galaxies, but there's still a lot about how they're formed that we don't understand. And one of the reasons for that is because stars are born inside dust clouds. So you've probably seen some of these beautiful images from the Hubble Space Telescope. One of its most famous images that is called it's the Eagle Nebula, but it's nicknamed the Pillars of Creation, because it's these gigantic dust clouds where baby stars are forming inside. And if you look at an image like this, you'll see it looks like, it looks like a cloud of dust, because that's what it is. But of course, visible light can't see through dust. But with Webb's infrared capabilities, we'll be able to pierce through the dust, literally see through the dust, to sites of where stars are being born. And then beyond stars, the next big science theme, and I think one of the most exciting, will be what I believe will be revolutionary science of exoplanets. So planets orbiting other stars outside of our own solar system. When I was a kid, we only knew about the planets in our own solar system. Now we know that the Milky Way galaxy is literally teeming with planets. So that's a paradigm shift in our understanding of the universe. Planets are literally everywhere in the Milky Way. So with previous telescopes, we've been able to discover that the planets are out there, but they are not quite powerful enough to really determine what those exoplanets are like. So with Webb, what we're going to be able to do is watch these exoplanets as they orbit the stars. And so at some point, the planet will pass in front of the star. And when it does that, we'll be able to look at the starlight that's filtering through the planet's atmospheres. And by doing that, we'll be able to learn about what those atmospheres are like. And we'll be able to sort of take the next big step in determining what planets might be suitable for life on the surface. So some really incredible science from the most distant universe all the way to nearby. And we'll also be able to learn a lot about planets in our own solar system.
Now, as we've discussed previously on this podcast, the emerging private space industry is disrupting space travel and exploration. But one of the other things companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Virgin Galactic are doing, perhaps somewhat inadvertently, is raising the question of why we're exploring space at all. Why is spending money on interacting more with space worth it?
So that's a great question, and I believe it's a question that we as society have to answer. because, of course, the telescopes that NASA builds are built with taxpayer money, right? And so we have to determine as a society if it's worth it. And of course, I'm an astronomer, so of course I think it's worth it. But I believe that we as an American society do have this value of knowledge. We have the value of pushing past boundaries, of learning fundamental things about our universe and about our world, our surroundings. I believe that this value helps propel science forward. And in a fundamental sense, learning about the universe helps us learn about ourselves. We humans on this planet Earth, we're born out of the universe. And so in some sort of big sense, when we look out at the universe, we're really looking to our origins. We're trying to answer the big questions about our existence, about where we came from and how we got here. And, then extending that further, that question of, are we alone? Are there other intelligent beings out there in the universe? And I believe these are more than just sort of arcane science questions. They're fundamental human questions that get to our drive as human beings to explore and to discover. And of course, in addition to that, anytime you do fundamental research, you get technology benefits. You can list 100 different technologies that we use in our everyday life, from GPS to cell phones to medical technologies that directly derive from fundamental research and even research that NASA specifically has done. one sort of specific example that directly resulted from web technology has to do with ophthalmology. So let me give you that quick little example. So the Webb telescope mirror is huge. I think I mentioned it's about 6.5 meters across, about 21 feet across, and it has to be perfectly smooth. So if you stretched out that Webb mirror to be the size of the continental US, the biggest bump on the mirror would only be a couple inches high. So that's pretty remarkable. This mirror is super, super smooth. But to prove it's that smooth, we have to measure it very, very precisely. And building an instrument to measure the mirror smoothness with this precision was very difficult, but we've done it. And that technology to measure the shape of the mirror is already being used in ophthalmology so that doctors can more accurately measure the shape of the human eye to make eye surgery better. So that's one sort of specific example from Webb. But of course, there are a ton of other examples from NASA technology that have spun off to directly benefit us here on Earth.
Given that argument, what should you do if you have the bug for space exploration? How do you go from looking up at the stars from your own backyard to looking at them through the lens of the most ambitious space telescope to date?
I was the first person in my family to go to college. I grew up in rural Arkansas, middle of nowhere, north central Arkansas, on a farm, on a little family farm. My dad raised beef cattle and he was a mechanic. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom when I was a kid and worked at a bank later on. I was interested in astronomy from the time I was a really young kid. And I sort of credit that to growing up in rural Arkansas because the sky was so beautiful and so dark and you could see thousands of stars from the tiny little town where I grew up. And so I loved astronomy from the time I was a kid and I just sort of went for it. I pursued it. And my parents and my teachers in school were always, very encouraging of me. And it was just something I always wanted to do. And I had a whole lot of help along the way, of course. The two biggest pieces of advice I would give to young folks interested in astronomy or really any other area of science or anything that's difficult. The first one is to seek out mentors. So anything difficult, you can't do it by yourself. Even at NASA, we work on teams, we work together to advance things. And I've had a whole bunch all along the way of amazing mentors that have helped me to get to where I am. So that's my first piece of advice, is just to seek out mentors, people that are willing to help you learn what you need to learn, find out what you need to do to get to the next step. Being a first-gen college student, of course, I couldn't really talk to my parents about applying to college or applying for scholarships and grants and those sorts of things. And so I had a great counselor in high school to help me figure all that stuff out. So mentors are incredibly important. I still have mentors today that help me learn and help me become better at my job and that sort of thing. And then I guess the second big piece of advice I would give, particularly to students that are sort of just starting out on their path, is to seek out the extra opportunities. So of course, it's important to, get grades and all that stuff and work hard, all the standard stuff. But I believe that my ending up at NASA was the result of people helping me for sure, but of also just taking small steps, and doing extra things that helped me to land the next thing. So one example of that, starting off early in junior high, I started applying for and attending some summer academic camps in Arkansas. So where I'd go for a week to learn more about math. And then the fact that I did that allowed me, once I got further on in high school, to go to a more extensive summer program. And that helped me with getting scholarships to go to college. And then in college, I joined a team that built an experiment to fly on a NASA aircraft. And so it's just all these, like, what at the time seemed like little extra things helped me sort of a stepping stone to get to the next big thing. And ultimately, that's ended in a job at NASA, which is a whole lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rocket Launch Pod. A very special thank you to Amber Strawn for appearing on the program. Audio for this episode came from the NASA Audio Archives, the Ronald Reagan Foundation, the CBS News Archives, and SpaceX. Additional information for this podcast came from the book The Space Barons by Christian Davenport and from The Smithsonian History of Space Exploration by Roger Lyons. If you like the Rocket Launch Pod, please remember to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Nate Ray, and I'll see you next time.